What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. It's Connor from Intelligence Squared. And before we go to this week's episode, I want to let you know about a very special offer we have for all our listeners. As many of you will be aware, we have migrated to the online space in recent months and launched a new subscription service called Intelligence Squared Plus. We've been having some fantastic debates and discussions from Mehdi Hassan on Iran to Thomas Piketty on capital and ideology. So if you would like to take part in these events, ask your questions to some of our speakers and even watch back all our previous events, then please go to intelligencesquared.com and subscribe today with a special 20% off discount using the code PODCAST. That's PODCAST. And join us over the next few months as we deal with issues such as taming the coronavirus pandemic and look at the upcoming election in the United States with New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman. So get started today and join the debate via the link in our podcast description. And this week we were joined by Ashley Dottie Charles, BBC presenter, DJ and author of the new book Outraged, Why Everyone is Shouting and No One is Talking. And she had a really interesting conversation with Ash Sarkar, the journalist and commentator, all about how outrage is being used and co-opted in the digital age and how we might be able to reclaim our emotions and put them to more constructive purposes. So it's a fascinating conversation and we hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Ash Sarkar, writer and senior editor at Novara Media, and I'm super excited to be here, well, in a social distanced kind of way, with Ashley Dottie Charles, BBC presenter and author of the new book, Outraged, Why Everyone is Shouting and No One is Talking. Welcome, Dottie. It's so good to meet you, even though I can't see you.
How are you doing, Ash?
I'm feeling good. How's your lockdown going?
It's all right now that I'm back in the studio at work. I think I was going slowly insane working from home. I think working from home is a real test. Which I was failing, but I'm all right now. I think
you've
now
got
that
a toddler, right?
I have, which makes working from home even more of a challenge. But yeah, he now wants to be a radio presenter, so some good has come of this.
I mean, that's pretty good. One of my my brother is just like, it feels like being in a hostage situation, and my cat is like 2 foot tall.
That is so accurate. I wish I came up with it myself.
Well, you can steal that one because he doesn't have a career in the public eye. So,
so he'll never know.
He will never know. I don't even know if he'll listen to this podcast. more for him. I mean, so I just want to jump right into it. You describe yourself in the book as a social media crackhead, and I can relate to that. So when did you first realize that you weren't a recreational user, you know, dabbling here and there, you know, special nights out? You were an addict.
I realized I was a social media crackhead when I would start to post things and then obsess over their performance. You know, like you might put a picture up and you'll just get on with your day, or you'll post a tweet and then just close the app. I would post a tweet and then I'd need to check if anybody had replied to it. And then I'd need to check if anyone had retweeted it. And then I'd post a picture and I'd be like, okay, how has it performed? And I realized that this sort of this egocentric attitude that we have to social media is actually quite insidious in other ways, and was actually a big basis of the book that I wrote.
I mean, do you feel that that was something that was always in your personality, that maybe you're a bit competitive or you were driven by numbers, or was it the design of the platform?
Oh, it's absolutely the design of the platform coupled with my vocation. I think we, in these positions, when we, you know, if we're broadcasters or people that are influencers or authors or just writers, where you kind of, you're measured on your reach. you're measured on engagement. So as soon as there is this platform that gives you a metric, which allows you to sort of measure that in really, really simple ways, you can inadvertently start to obsess over your performance.
I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, my partner's not on social media, and when he can see me getting really het up about something, he's like, these people aren't real. They're just handles. Why is this in your head so much? Why is this bleeding over to your everyday life? Do you find that is something which has affected your real life relationships as well as changing how you relate to social media platforms?
Well, I like to think of myself as a social media addict in recovery. So I've done the rehab and I'm kind of on the other side, and I can be like somebody else's sponsor in Social Media Anonymous, because I do feel like I've actually come out the other side. My relationship with social media now is so different to the relationship I used to have with it. And I think that is because I did recognize that it was impacting me in a way that was unhealthy. I think we can switch social media off, but we can't always switch off the way it makes us feel. So if I've gone onto Twitter and I've read something that's upset me, that sits with me long after I've logged off the app. And I think I just started to recognize the power I have to curate my own online experience. We don't give ourselves enough credit for the amount of control we have over our lives, over our experiences, over what we consume. And as soon as I sort of reminded myself of that power, my relationship with social media completely changed. And now I use it for what it is. It's you know, a vehicle. It's something that can sort of spark conversation, but it's not where I continue my conversations or where I hang out for a long period of time trying to engage in dialogues.
I mean, you're starting to sound dangerously sensible and optimistic, so I'm going to drag you right back to the darkness years where you really lost your way. You know, it's the bit in the Martin Scorsese films where it all starts to come apart. Tell me about how you came to write this book and where the seed of the idea came from.
So I wrote this book, actually, it was inspired by an article I wrote. So I wrote an article in January of 2018 for The Guardian, which was me responding to a backlash that H&M were experiencing over a hoodie. So H&M, many people will remember, in 2018 had a hoodie, a Wild Style series, and one of the hoodies said "Coolest Monkey in the Jungle," and they had this advertised by a black boy, and there was mass outrage, which suggested that this was a racist decision made by H&M. Now, as a black woman myself, I have to kind of be selective in what I'm outraged by. Like, on paper, there is so much that could and perhaps should outrage me, but because I don't want to give myself an aneurysm and be in a perpetual state of outrage, I try to be selective. So I try to look at things and say, is this something that I should get really outraged about? And should I allow this to impact my mental health? And should I engage in the dragging of H&M? And I realized that it just didn't warrant it. In my view, this was outrage gone mad. So I wrote an article talking about how we were kind of devaluing the currency of outrage by using it on trivial things like a H&M hoodie. And when I was writing this article, I realized that this was, the outrage industry is huge, and it's quite difficult to sum it up in sort of 2,000 words. So as soon as I did the article, I had this appetite to write the book. But what really fueled it was people responding and sharing that article. It went a bit viral, and it was shared widely. And people were saying, yes, let's have this conversation, because outrage is in a place where it's almost become ineffectual, because we are just perpetually outraged, and therefore we're not actually getting anything done. Can we have this sobering conversation? And people were saying, write another article. And I realized that it was so much more than an article. It was something that really needed to be unpacked. And so I spent 2 years unpacking it, and now we have a book.
No, also, you're like, I'm going to need a bit more than that £100 Guardian comment fee. This is a book deal, my friend.
Give me some more zeros after that comma, mate. This is some more,
like, look how viral it went. I'm not having, you know, Kath Viner snap up all the peas. I mean, in that piece, you phrase it as when people are getting outraged and they're participating in social media and they're really invested in that dragging, they're also saying something about themselves as much as the thing that they're criticizing. And what they're saying is, I am offended, therefore I am principled. So there's this element of projection that you identify. And one of the things I was wondering when I read your, you know, diagnosis is that there are also different kinds of offense. So there's responding to what you might call a micro event, like the H&M hoodie thing, which is this little snapshot moment which gets amplified through social media. And then there's something like when people saw the slave auction in Libya or police brutality, which is offensive to our sense of human dignity. But by the time these things reach a mainstream media audience, it's all been flattened and reduced into a question of offense, which both elevates one thing and minimizes another. So do you think that the word offense is enough to encompass this kind of mood you're talking about? Or is there a different word we need, a different kind of feeling we're identifying?
I think, look, outrage is scalable, and the transgressions that spark our outrage are scalable. You know, something that you may consider a misstep, I may consider like a real crime, and vice versa. And I think part of what this book is for is to kind of encourage people to recognize the power they have. And part of that power is, yes, when should you and when should you not be outraged, but also recognizing for yourself in your own terms when something warrants your personal outrage. And that's not to say that we, you know, we shouldn't be allies. There are times when we can lend ourselves to conversations that, although do not directly impact us, we have a sort of a moral obligation to further that movement. What I'm talking about is quite often these smaller transgressions or offenses that at times we are responding to because the masses are responding to. And that's why on occasion, and in fact, I'd say more often than not in social media terms, the crime is so disproportionate to the fallout. And I think we see that a lot. And I look at some of those case studies in the book, times where the reaction has in no way been in keeping with the actual size of the offense. But as you say, sometimes it's an offense, sometimes it's a misstep, sometimes it's a grave error. And I think different things are different to different people.
I mean, for me, one of the most fascinating bits of the book, and I was hooked, was when you're interviewing Rachel Dolezal, and you reached out to her, you got the story behind the social media outrage, and it seems to me that you were still really conflicted about her as a person, because on the one hand, she's talking about how perhaps she was unfairly targeted for sounding the alarm on an instance of police brutality, the death of Lorenzo Hayes in Spokane. But on the other hand, and you kind of end on this question, you know, she's arrested for various kinds of fraud. And so that interaction with her, what do you feel you came to understand about her that you didn't have a grasp of before? And I know this is a bit binary, but what do you think? Con artist or victim?
Do you know what? So the thing with Rachel Dolezal, and the reason why I wanted to include her in this book, is because, not that I don't care about Rachel Dolezal as an individual, because I think as a person and her crime, quote unquote, for anybody who's not familiar with the story, is she was a white woman that was pretending to be black. And in doing so, look, she was occupying spaces that were intended for black women. She was speaking on issues which she had never experienced. There was many layers to why that choice she made was problematic. But to me, she is one woman in Spokane, Washington, a place I've never been and I assume we'll never go, right? So how she chose to identify was kind of secondary to me in this book. What I cared about was how that one person's story in this place that we'd never heard of was suddenly huge news. It was a national outrage. And what is it? What can we learn from her story? And what does it tell us about the mechanics of outrage? So I think Rachel Dozel as an individual is nowhere near as fascinating as what her case study actually tells us about who we are in matters of outrage. And I'm to answer your other question, I am conflicted because, look, it's a white woman pretending to be black. And let's remind ourselves, she was pretending to be black. She was found out. Then she doubled down on her blackness. She didn't say, do you know what? You got me. She just continued to claim that she was transracial. And then she spoke to me and done an interview in which she kind of tripled down, and she was still adamant that she was black. So, of course, there's something nuts going on there. But my purpose wasn't to sort of psychoanalyze Rachel Dozel and whether or not she's an absolute psychopath. It was more in the context of outrage and to see what her story tells us about ourselves in matters of outrage.
So what do you think that particular instance told us about ourselves? Because I remember the story breaking and I thought it was absurd. And I also thought the anger that I'm seeing directed at her is a reflection of the fact that for lots of black women, they see that the cultural forms that they've pioneered, whether it's slang or fashion or hair or music, is appropriated, and then they get erased from that whole story. So everyone wants black culture, but nobody wants black people. You know, that for me is what the outrage was speaking to. But for you, what was that story telling?
That was a big part of it. I think she's, by sort of enacting this black face in the extreme, she was kind of the very picture of white supremacy, in that she was even able to be black and more successful than some black women. Look, let's not forget, this is a woman who was in an extremely high position within the NAACP. She was given access to spaces. She was holding the sort of police commissioners accountable. Here was a white woman that could pretend to be black and be sort of given the keys to the city, right? There's a huge issue in that. There's also, as you rightly say, the issue of cultural appropriation. But I think what Rachel Dozel tells us about ourselves is, in matters of outrage, we often go for what is within reach, right? Rachel Dozel is one human being. It's much easier to take her down. As a mob, it's much easier for us to say, do you know what? Everything that you represent is an affront to black womanhood, and we are going to take you down. It's much easier to do that. That's within reach. She's one woman in Spokane, Washington. It's easier to do that than it is to start to dismantle the systems that allow a Rachel Dozel to thrive, right? And quite often we do. We just go for the thing that's easier. It's very hard to start to, you know, dismantle the patriarchy, to start to, you know, dissemble systemic racism. These are huge, huge mountains, right? Mm-hmm. Rachel Dozel is a molehill, and it's much easier for us to just say, oh, do you know what? We can have that argument. We can fight that fight and just drag this person, rather than taking on the mammoth task of addressing institutions. And I think that is at times where we go wrong, because what did black women gain by quote unquote cancelling Rachel Dozel? Very little. But you see in the current climate of this real, this uprising with Black Lives Matter at the moment, you're seeing when there is an attempt to shift attitudes in institutions, and when we say, do you know what, we're going to make these infrastructures crumble and burn, you see that there is a renewed impetus and that there is tangible change. You know, you're seeing people like, you know, the mayor of New York saying, you know what, we're going to funnel money out of the police department and we're going to put that into education. You're seeing new laws in the wake of Breonna Taylor. You're seeing increased arrests. You're seeing people being forced to take accountability. There's been more achievement and more progress in the past sort of 3 weeks of uprising in it, sort of fueled by the Black Lives Matter movement, than we had after sort of 3 months of dragging Rachel Dolezal. And I think that's where we need to kind of assess what we are putting our efforts into.
But I mean, this is also the point where, you know, something which is just culture wars, which is sort of lots of hype around what you might call a micro event, and it sort of plays, you know, its role in dictating the media cycle, tips over into a real political conflict, which brings people out onto the streets. And as you said, it achieves real and tangible change. But there's not necessarily like a very neat dividing line between them. And the Black Lives Matter movement's a really good example of this, right? So when Black Lives Matter first comes out after the acquittal of George Zimmerman, it was a culture wars thing. It was, that's how it was covered in the press. You had, you know, even Piers Morgan being like, all lives matter. He's now changed his tune after the death of George Floyd. When Colin Kaepernick first took a knee, he was blacklisted. He was presented as public enemy number one. Whereas now you've got all of these elements which are now being seen as actually the acceptable compromise, right? Between what we had before and what the protesters are pushing for. And so the thing that I wanted to ask you about that process is, well, the first time you hear an idea and you get a sense of people's anger through social media, it's dismissed. But actually, that outrage, it doesn't necessarily fizzle out. It can sometimes deepen into people's consciousness and be a catalyst for something much bigger a few years down the line.
Do you know what? I think You're absolutely right. Social media can be, and the internet in general, can sort of, it can be to the betterment of activism and it can be to the detriment. I think it's kind of a double-edged sword, because it does, it kind of gives you a platform that allows you to do the bare minimum. It does. But what it also does is it gives you a vehicle that can be innovative and can mobilize your activism. And I think it depends on whether the conversations continue offline. I think a lot of people, as you rightly say, with Black Lives Matter, with Me Too, look, with Mute R. Kelly, there are so many conversations about accountability, about progress that start online. You only see the change when the conversation continues offline. So look, while the social media can spark the conversation, it's down to us to continue the dialogue in the real world. And I think that's where we see some online movements fizzle out and where we see some, as you say, really gather momentum.
I mean, one of the things that you said, I think quite early on in the book, is that outrage is sometimes driven by an expectation of racism rather than the intention of racism. Does racism always have to be intentional discrimination? And how do you draw that line between someone projecting because they occupy a marginalized position and they're so used to, you know, bullshit, to be blunt, that, you know, they're now just expecting it everywhere, and actually that sort of plausible deniability area where people can say, well, I never intended this to be the consequence of my action, but it certainly did have racist effects. How do you distinguish between these things?
I think it's, look, it's difficult to distinguish. And I think what we all need to do, what we collectively need to do, is we need to interrogate our subconscious. I think, well, I was just having this conversation today. I think we all need to interrogate our subconscious, because speaking about racism, as you mentioned, there are times when a white person may say something, not realizing that what they've said is rooted in white supremacy. They don't realize that their views have kind of been infiltrated by this quite insidious set of beliefs, right? And they find themselves having views that are problematic. And they'd say, well, I'm not racist. Racism isn't just hurling the N-word out at somebody, you know? It's the way in which it manifests itself in microaggressions, in behaviours that are sort of riddled with this subtext of prejudice, and you need to as white people interrogate your subconscious. But I also find myself interrogating my own subconscious when I consume things and saying, shit, is this offensive to me, or have I been beaten up so much by the world that my subconscious defenses are going up and encouraging me to view this as offensive? And I think that's the dichotomy, in that we kind of on both sides need to be interrogating those sort of unconscious voices that are telling us, A, that we're not being offensive, which I think a lot of people lean on and say, oh, I had no idea that this was offensive. I had no idea. But also in seeking out offense, I think we need to be aware that sometimes we are, and you know what, rightly so, mind. Rightly so. Like, if you have been a victim of systemic racism, of misogyny, transphobia, homophobia, you have every right, yeah, to feel as though you need to be defensive, to feel as though that there are things that are an affront to your very being, right? And it's not as easy as saying, oh, calm down, you're being too sensitive. And that was something I was conscious about when writing the book. It's not about saying, you know, everyone calm down, everyone stop being so sensitive, everyone stop being PC. No, it's not about that. It's about making sure that all of our decisions are sort of made with due care, really. And I think we all need to do more of, as I say, what I call interrogating our subconscious, but particularly people that sort of lean on that age old defense of, I didn't mean it in that way, which we hear all the time. And it's like, it's gaslighting, right? And it's like, you need to figure out the root causes of your views, because they can be very damaging when they go unchecked. But when people are not holding themselves accountable, I think that's when we have real ongoing issues.
Well, this seems to be a really good time for a quick break, because when we come back, we'll discuss someone who definitely very much knows what they're doing and the kind of offence they cause. So we'll be back.
We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents, with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared.
Okay, so I'm back for Intelligence Squared with Dottie talking about her new book about social media outrage and what it's doing to all of us. So, again, another fascinating interview, which is in this book, is with none other than Katie Hopkins. Now, we've been talking so far about people who do things unconsciously and who aren't aware of the effect that certain kinds of language or their actions, what effects that has on marginalized people. But Katie Hopkins is many things, but I don't think you could say she wasn't self-aware. So what was that interview like? What did you glean from her?
So Katie Hopkins, she is, what words do you use for Katie Hopkins without using expletives? It's tough. It's tough to approach this without using all manner of swear words. But look, Katie Hopkins is a bit of a stain on humanity. I'm sure many people will agree. In writing this book, though, I was looking at the outrage industry and how people benefit from our innate desire to defend ourselves and our innate need to kind of combat anything that is an affront to our very being. Katie Hopkins is somebody who has figured that out and has turned it into a business model.
Mm.
So my conversation with Katie Hopkins was coming from a place actually of cynicism. It was me looking at this person as an intentional villain, almost as a character, because I'm of the very firm belief that although Katie Hopkins probably over time has begun to subscribe to the hateful views she spouts, I think she created this character and she's kind of just got lost in it, because the villain that she has created with brand Katie has kept her at the forefront of people's minds for a decade, which is insanity. How many people from The Apprentice do you remember by first and last name? Probably very few. Even if you religiously watch The Apprentice,
I mean, I kind of feel that The Apprentice has been a force for evil. You know, it's produced like Alan Sugar, Donald Trump, and Katie Hopkins. I think it's time to.
There needs to be some kind of investigative reporting into the evil that had spawned from The Apprentice. I agree, but look, Katie Hopkins was just somebody who didn't even win. She wasn't even in the final of The Apprentice, but she's still a name that is so instantly recognizable now. And she wouldn't have got that by being nice. So she created a character which could provoke, which could prompt engagement. And she's been dining out on it, as I say, for the best part of a decade, which is why she's a sort of person I felt this book needed. You know, it's kind of a necessary evil when writing a book on outrage, is that you kind of speak to the subjects of our outrage. And that means sometimes spending a great deal of time with the Wicked Witch of the East, that is Katie Hopkins.
I mean, one of the things that you point out in the book is that she wants nothing more than to be able to say that she is being targeted by a campaign to get her cancelled. That's what she gets up for in the morning. It's what she wants. So how do you strike a balance between denying somebody what Margaret Thatcher very famously called the oxygen of publicity, but also having a conversation about who gets a platform in the first place? What kind of voices do we elevate? And what does that come at the expense of? So how do you strike that balance?
So I think this kind of goes back to what I often say in matters of outrage. We need to be trying to cut down the tree rather than pulling down the branches. It's something that I return to because Katie Hopkins is a mere branch, right? She has been empowered by, oh God, the Sun. She's been empowered by LBC. She's actually had two radio shows. She's had numerous columns. She was actually poached to go to another newspaper. Like these are the institutions with which we need to take issue. Not a person that they've empowered, because there will just be another Katie Hopkins. Do you know what I mean? There are, right now, there are hundreds of thousands of Katie Hopkins online. But we've empowered this one and we've allowed her to dine out on it. And I think we need to recognise, again, how powerful we are. So say we get Katie Hopkins cancelled, because let's be honest, there was a couple of years ago, she got fired from her last position. So she's off LBC and she's no longer being empowered by any of the sort of the big media platforms, yeah, in the UK. But she's still relevant, because from her lowly IP, we are still engaging with her. So what do we want? If Katie Hopkins has been fired and we're still kind of feeding the beast by retweeting her and engaging with her, what are we actually hoping to happen? Do you know what I mean? I think there should always be an end game. There should always be a goal. When you're outraged by something, there should be a goal. What is the aim with Katie Hopkins? Like, what do we stand to gain from engaging with her?
I mean, I suppose this also speaks to a huge change in how the media works as an industry. So once upon a time, there was a very clear hierarchy between, you know, print media, broadcast media, and what you might call self-publishing, right? Which was initially what social media was. But then, you know, Facebook and Twitter just completely explode. And at the same time, you've got declining newspaper sales. You've got, you know, an aging population watching mainstream broadcast media. So you've got a whole generation of young people who aren't following their parents in terms of viewing habits. And that balance of power, it hasn't necessarily been turned upside down, but it's not so clear as to say, you know, once you get someone off the mainstream media, they no longer have power. It's just this much more nebulous and weird power, which is driven by our own engagement. So the more we say Katie Hopkins is a problem in society, Katie Hopkins can become a problem in society, because that's the engagement.
I think, do you know what we do, and it's crazy how we do this so much, is we give life to the things we want to die, you know? Mm. We inadvertently kind of boost the exposure of the things we wish had less reach, you know? And I think Katie Hopkins as a case study is an interesting one, because quite often I don't follow Katie Hopkins, right? I actually never have followed Katie Hopkins, but I see so much of what she says because of people that I do follow retweeting her, and then above the retweet saying, how do you get off on saying blah 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 blah, and it's like, you've now exposed that view to more people. You have increased its reach. And I think, again, it's about recognizing our own power. I wrote this book so that people would feel empowered and realize how much control they have when it comes to outrage and how much they can actually use it for progress. Because you give so much power to Katie Hopkins when you engage and when you retweet. And it's not just Katie Hopkins. If you want something to die, you cannot give it life. And that is what we do so often when engaging in sort of a war of words with people like her.
I mean, one of the things that I really liked, and this was towards the end of your book, and I really liked the conversational way in which it's written. So it's not this like very dense, very like academic, very dry text. You can hear your voice, and then there's a lot of life and vibrancy in it. It feels like your mate is talking you through a set of really complicated ideas, but you can understand at every point. And that's a really, really nice thing about the writing. And one such element was when you wrote, yeah, it's fun to kick big corporations in the dick, and there are a few things more satisfying than a snivelling plea for mercy. But when someone is backed into a corner, holding their hands up and pleading for forgiveness, outrage no longer has a purpose. And so one of the things that you talk about is that, well, brands, they back down and they'll apologize and they'll hold their hands up and go, you know, we apologize for the offense we've caused, but nothing really changes. We're still caught in this cycle of offense and outrage, offense and outrage. And our society still looks unequal. Patriarchy's still there. White supremacy's still there. So in your mind, what would a healthier culture around accountability look like? And if we give up on outrage, do we risk simply giving up on the idea that we can change the status quo at all?
I don't think we give up on outrage at all. And in this book, I say this isn't about being outraged less. It's about being, you know, outraged better. And I think we can be so much better in our outrage. And look, let's be honest, trivial outrage is at times, look, escapism from like real trauma, right? So if you have experienced the real trauma, for example, of racism on a real life scale, as I said, it can be a bit of escapism to start slagging off some brand that has done something, you know, a little bit off color, because it feels surmountable. It feels like a bit of escapism. It's not take Dolce and Gabbana, for example, who have been a sort of a problematic brand in this area. Look, they're not the biggest culprits. You shut down Dolce and Gabbana for argument's sake. You know, the world's racism issues don't go away. You probably don't even feel any dent in it. But it feels good sometimes, as I said, to just kick a corporation in the dick. And it's about figuring out where our outrage is best placed. And I don't say this to kind of be dismissive of outrage. I completely understand why we at times engage in what a face value looks like frivolous outrage. There are so many reasons, some of which I explore in the book, but I think we just need to be a bit more diligent and vigilant in our outrage, because not everything requires it.
Do you think that this particular kind of outrage that you're identifying is that it comes from a place of disempowerment? So you talk about there being times in the past where outrage was more effective and it was focused and it secured wins, whereas we've seen a kind of perhaps slow disintegration of some of the progress that was achieved, you know, progress stalled and some cases it went backwards, but instead we got given this tool of social media. So do you think that there's been a kind of bait and switch? We think that we're empowered by doing this, but actually we're just, you know, digging the hole that we're trying to escape from.
I think social media, it does empower us. I think it really can make us better activists. And I think there's a bit of snobbery around this term activist, which says, well, in order to be an activist, you have to be at the front of the protest, and you need to be at all times, you need to be in a state of revolution, all right? And activism can be in subtle forms of resistance. And I think it's important to recognize the limitations of social media in that. It's a great way to mobilize. It's an innovative platform that can further the conversations, but it's not going to be the forum within which we actually get things done. And I think it's really about figuring that out. And it's what I try and do in the book, is kind of take you on an outrage safari that says, yes, look, there are reasons why we engage in this sort of frivolous, disposable outrage. It's virtual signaling. We reaffirm our allegiances. There are so many reasons we do engage in outrage. It can be a rush, but if it isn't rooted in activism, then it's never going to bear the fruit of change.
Well, we mentioned earlier the explosion of Black Lives Matter protests across the world following the killing of George Floyd. And it feels that we're in a different moment politically. It's generation defining what's going on. So what do you think has changed since you wrote the book? And is there anything that makes you feel optimistic for the future?
I don't know. I actually don't think anything has changed since I wrote the book, which is I'm so happy it's coming out now. But the reality in this book, which I found just rereading it myself the other day, is it's a book that could have come out last year. It could come out now. And sadly, it could probably still come out next year or the year after that, because we are in a pivotal time where we are seeing disposable outrage. Like, look at Dominic Cummings sort of breaking lockdown in comparison to George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter uprising, which were weeks apart, days apart, really, if we're looking at sort of media coverage. I think what we're seeing is the different ways that we can mobilize our outrage. I think we need to remind ourselves of how much change we can actually bring about. With Dominic Cummings, I think there was no real impetus behind the outrage. It was kind of like, again, like kicking a corporation in the dick. What do you want out of Dominic Cummings? He gets fired. Does the system itself change? No. Someone else does his job. The government effectively proceed as normal. But when there's a real aim, like with Black Lives Matter, when there is intent to dismantle racial bias, when there is this intent to burn white supremacy to the ground, and there is a collective desire to dismantle, you know, structural racism, systemic racism, when there is that sort of ambition and that goal, and there's a collective movement towards it, you see change. And I think we need to remind ourselves that when we look back over the course of history at moments of real change, nothing happened overnight. You know, the suffragettes didn't put in 2 weeks of work. Martin Luther King didn't, you know, do an 8-thread post on why we needed a Civil Rights Act.
I have a dream, one of eight.
But as you say, yeah, it wasn't like one of eight in a thread. So I think we need to just be more sustained in our outrage and to realize that we have a real power to affect change. Outrage was once sort of the mouthpiece of real activism. And I think what we're seeing in the midst of this, which is why it's absolutely crazy timing that the book is coming out, we're seeing again almost a sort of a renaissance of that old school activism. And I think this will hopefully be a watershed moment, a new dawn in reminding us that our outrage can really plant the seeds of change.
So use social media to sustain social movements rather than
thinking about... Yeah, and you know what? Many people will see something on social media which will spark a conversation. And that is where social media can be so powerful in raising awareness, in heightening visibility, right? But it's so important that we continue those conversations offline. You know, so much of the heightened awareness around the Black Lives Matter movement is happening online, but the real work is happening in the real world.
I mean, that seems like a really nice, optimistic note to end on. You've taken me on the journey of your recovery. I feel like I've been at the Betty Ford Clinic and, you know, forced to go cold turkey and talk about my childhood and group therapy. And now maybe I can kick the habit of refreshing my Twitter feed. Maybe. I mean, the thing is that I'm an addict who doesn't want to change.
Oh, shit.
You know, the first step's admitting you have a problem. And I'm like, what problem?
Yeah. Okay. You're a long way away from your 1 week key ring that we give out.
Yeah, I think
once you've managed to log out for 7 days, I mean, you're away away from that.
You'd be a very diligent sponsor.
When you're ready, when you're ready to kick the habit, Ash, all right, I am but a phone call away.
Well, that can be podcast number two, or even the second book, even the second book.
So, The Road to Recovery with Ash Akar.
Thank you so much for joining us, Dotty. Just to remind everyone, her book is called Outraged, Why Everyone is Shouting and No One is Talking. It is a really accessible read. It's a really nuanced book, and it's something which I think feels so timely and so immediate. So definitely go out and get it. Dotty, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.